Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, New Stent Technologies, Clinical Applications of Evidence-Based Medicine, which is certified by Medscape and presented by ENT Meredith, MBBS, PhD, and Craig W. Stone, MD. Dr. Meredith is a professor of cardiology and medicine, Monash University, director, Monash Heart, Monash Medical Center, Southern Health, Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Meredith has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Medtronic, Boston Scientific, and Abbott Laboratories. He served as a speaker or a member of a speakers bureau for Medtronic, Boston Scientific, and Abbott Laboratories. Dr. Stone is a professor of medicine, director, Cardiovascular Research and Education, Center for Interventional Vascular Therapy, New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center, co-director, Medical Research and Education Division, the Cardiovascular Research Foundation, New York, New York. Dr. Stone has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Osprey Pharmaceuticals USA, Riva Medical, Merck & Company, Abbott Laboratories, Boston Scientific, Eli Lilly & Company, Daiichi Sankyo, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Gilead Sciences, InspireMD, Therox, The Medicines Company, Atrium Medical Corporation, Infraredx, Volcano Corporation, Medtronic, Genentech, GlaxoSmithKline, and Miracor. He served as a speaker or a member of a speakers bureau for Vascular Solutions. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from Ovalum, Flowcardia, Caliber Therapeutics, Arstasis, MyCardia Corporation, Access Closure, Umbrella Cardiovascular, Guided Delivery Systems, BioStar Funds, MedFocus Funds, VNT, and Concrave. The purpose of this activity is to provide an update on clinical trial data about new stent technology. This activity is supported by Boston Scientific. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Ian Meredith, Professor and Director of Monash Heart in Melbourne. Welcome to our program, New Stent Technologies, Clinical Applications of Evidence-Based Medicine. I'm joined today by none other than Greg Stone, who is Professor of Medicine at Columbia University, and of course the brains trust behind the program at TCT. Greg, welcome.
Hi Ian, how are you?
Now, Greg, during this week, we've seen a vast array of new different stent technologies and a number of different platforms and designs. What do you think this all means?
Yeah. Well, Ian, it's a lot of people ask the question, do we really need new drug-eluting stents, a next generation of drug-eluting stents? And there's no doubt that we've gotten a lot better from where we came. From the first generation, the original Cypher sirolimus-eluting stent and the Taxus paclitaxel-eluting stent. Now with the second generation, which I think are most typified by the Zions V Promus or Promus Element everolimus-eluting stents and the Resolute platform zotarolimus-eluting stent, we've really seen fairly marked reductions in both MACE rates as well as improved safety, especially with the everolimus-eluting stents in terms of reducing stent thrombosis. So the question is, how much better can we get? The event rates are getting really, really low. But I would argue that drug-eluting stents are by no means perfect. I mean, they're still associated with polymer hypersensitivity reactions, occasional strut fractures, longitudinal deformation, which we talked a lot about this week, malapposition, aneurysms, late loss, abnormal vasomotion. I can go on and on and on. And what this translates to is still there's, in my mind, an unacceptable incidence of both early and late stent thrombosis.
So do you think that bioabsorbable, abluminal bioabsorbable polymers or truly bioabsorbable stents are the answer? Is it, do you think we've seen enough from this meeting to say that this is obviously the direction we should take from all of these different technologies? Is there anything that's shined from all that for you?
Well, again, I think it's a little more complex than just bioabsorbable polymers, bioabsorbable stents, because the question is, again, I get back to what problems are we trying to address? And we have to address stent thrombosis, particularly late stent thrombosis. We have to address continuing late loss. We see that even with the best stents, the everolimus-eluting stents or the zotarolimus-eluting stents, there's about a 1 or 1.5% TLR rate per year.
Yes.
And we've got you know, a nation or a world of people who are addicted to thienopyridines to try to prevent stent thrombosis. Yes. So beyond metallic-based drug-eluting stents with durable polymers, people are looking at metallic stents with bioabsorbable polymers, polymer-free metallic stents that are still drug-eluting, and then fully bioabsorbable stents. So there's kind of a progression here, and different sponsors are working on different types of stents, and we've seen examples of all of them here at TCT. And the results right now are in still very small studies. We see some hints of promise, but you know, it's going to take very large studies and a lot of patients to see if we can equal or exceed the early events within a year, and then perhaps equal or exceed the later events beyond 1 year.
So we did see early in the week, though, this a series of, as you say, abluminal bioabsorbable polymer stents, many of them with very low late loss using some form of Lemus product, and also excellent results from truly non-polymeric stents. Do you think that for the, all of these technologies to reach clinical practice is going to require a huge investment? How will we rationalize these? How will we work out which of these is the best one to actually pursue?
Well, I think there are, you know, drug-eluting stents being implanted in millions of patients every year. So, I mean, it is a significant public health problem. It's a global health problem, and it justifies the expense. And the better products, the better devices are going to be rewarded in that they are the ones that will be and should be used in the majority of patients. Right now, you can see with the results that we've achieved just with the durable polymer-based everolimus-eluting stent, they're being used in about 60 or 65% of patients around the world. So the question is to justify switching from a very good stent right now, we're going to have to see better outcomes. And it's got to be clinical outcomes. It can't be soft things like vasomotion and differences in OCT appearance, et cetera. So I do think that we can improve upon the outcomes we're seeing today with drug-eluting stents. Perhaps not as much in the first year, although possibly in the first year, but I'm more optimistic between years 1 and 5 as the polymer is gone, as the drug has completely eluted, or in the case of a bioabsorbable stent, as the or bioabsorbable scaffold, as the scaffold has completely resolved, and now you've got the artery back in its pristine state, so it has normal vasomotion restored. We know that leads to production of eNOS and nitric oxide, which is important for vascular health. Hopefully that will lead to a retardation of both stent thrombosis and neoatherosclerosis at that abnormal stent site. So these will be big studies. But if they do show improvements in long-term events, then it will justify their development and their preferential use.
Great answer, Greg. Can I just come back a little bit to the stent thrombosis issue? Because you've mentioned that the low rate of events that we're actually seeing with everolimus-eluting stents currently, this meeting was frequently said, well, why do we need these stents? Because we have a 0.1 to 0.2% stent thrombosis rate. But I'd like you to tease out for us what that really means and who we're referring to when we say 0.1 or 0.2% stent thrombosis rate.
That's because, really the key.
It's a catch cry. Everybody is saying this. But
it's really not 0.1 or 0.2%. First of all, I think we're learning that one of the most powerful predictors of stent thrombosis is implantation in patients with ST segment elevation MI and probably non-ST segment elevation MI as well. And what they've got in common is that they are ruptured thin-capped fibroatheromas, a metabolically active lesion with this rich necrotic core. It's a thrombotic environment, and Vermani and others have shown that it just doesn't heal. And it's got a high rate of subsequent stent thrombosis. Three to four times.
That is something that we didn't realize to start with, necrotic plaque is a wasteland that may not necessarily ever endothelialize correctly.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I'd say that, you know, we probably are at around 0.1 or 0.2%, you know, within the first 30 days when we do PCI with unstable coronary artery disease, more classic garden variety atherosclerosis, pathologic intimal thickening or fibrocalcific plaque. But when we're putting stents in these higher risk lesions, the 30-day stent thrombosis rates, and we just showed this in the ADAPT-ES registry, even with the second generation stents, is more like 0.5, 0.6, 0.7%. And then it keeps marching up every single year, and you know, we don't see an end in sight, frankly, when it stops. So we clearly do need safer stents, especially for these high-risk patients.
And certainly, as you said earlier, long-term dual antiplatelet therapy just to smother the problem may not necessarily be the best answer.
It may not be the best answer, and we don't even know if it works. It's being done because everyone's nervous about it, and you know, stent thrombosis has devastating consequences, and so we would like it not to occur, but we also have to make sure, of course, that the cure is not worse than the disease. And we saw, for example, in the PRODIGY trial, in which mostly first-generation stents were randomized to either 6 months or 24 months of a dual antiplatelet therapy compared to just aspirin alone after mostly elective PCI, that from 6 to 24 months, keeping the clopidogrel on board led to no incremental suppression of ischemic events, but a significant increase in major bleeding. So we need to find the right patients in whom these prolonged agents do effectively suppress ischemic events more so than causing iatrogenic bleeding.
So with what you've just said, how do you reconcile that with the data that basically shows that clopidogrel responsiveness does predict the likelihood of events? You're aware of all the Verify Now type platelet reactivity studies and showing the scatter of responsiveness to clopidogrel and the relationships we've actually seen generated as a result of those range of responsiveness, indicating that patients that aren't responsive to clopidogrel seem to be at the highest risk of events. So how do you reconcile that with what you've just said about the PRODIGY trial?
It's a complicated question with a sophisticated answer, but actually when you think about it all, it's all consistent and it's all clear. So let me step back. What we've seen is that, and we've seen this now in the largest registry presented, which we actually did, called ADAPT-ES, which was in over 8,600 patients, we found a strong relationship between clopidogrel hyporesponsiveness and stent thrombosis within 30 days of all stent types, not second generation, first generation, it didn't matter. However, when you look at the sensitivity and specificity of those tests, they're not very good. And what this means is that if you look at a whole population of patients, yes, clopidogrel hyporesponsiveness does predict stent thrombosis. But given the poor specificity and sensitivity, you can't predict which one patient is going to benefit. Most such patients, given the low prevalence of the event, are not going to have an event. And so knowing the platelet function response moves it up a little bit or down a little bit on average, but doesn't change it a lot. So in contrast, you've got to treat 99.5% of patients with another agent or a prolonged duration of an agent that is going to cause more bleeding with relatively little benefit. So the application of this gets more important, again, when you look at the ACS population and the non-ACS population. The non-ACS population, extremely low event rates. And we've now seen in Gravitas and in Trigger PCI that even if you're clopidogrel hyporesponsive, the event rates are so low in that patient population, at least within the first year, that excess therapy isn't helpful. It can only cause harm. In contrast, we've seen in the PLATO trial and the Triton-TIMI 38 trial that when you put in stents, either bare metal or drug-eluting, in high-risk ACS patients, that clearly, as a population, you overall reduce the rate of stent thrombosis. And so what we don't yet have information for is can you cherry pick which one of those patients need the more potent agent or not. I suspect that given the poor sensitivity and specificity of these tests, the answer is no, you should just treat the whole population, as long as they're not at excessive risk for bleeding.
But would it be fair to say that the patients at the highest risk of stent thrombosis are those of the patients that are the highest risk for target lesion repeat target lesion revascularization, the patients with instability, the patients with long lesions, diabetics, bifurcations. Yeah. Should we be focusing our attention then on new stent technologies, abdominal bioabsorbable polymers, truly bioabsorbable stents, on those populations rather than necessarily the lower risk patient populations where the need for dual antiplatelet therapy, as you've just said, may not necessarily be prolonged?
Yeah, I would think in general that's a fair statement. I mean, we've got to separate out the risk of stent thrombosis versus the risk of restenosis. And more we see when you follow patients long term, there's also this late catch-up phenomenon. So if I switch to restenosis for a minute, and we're getting more and more understanding that probably in a high frequency of the cases, it's probably due to what's called so-called neoatherosclerosis. Mm. Where you get some neointima, and then the neointima actually converts to a more atherosclerotic type phenotype, and it develops a necrotic core. Mm. And then that can keep progressing by either rupturing and then healing and rupturing and healing, and it can either lead to late restenosis or either even very late stent thrombosis. So this is why I think if we have more passivated stents without the polymer, if the polymer is a problem, and we should talk about that because the polymer may be a solution, not a problem, and then ultimately bioabsorbable stents, that may be very effective in solving this late problem for both stent thrombosis and restenosis.
So there was a number of interesting things you said then, and I'd like to just touch on this issue of neoatherosclerosis. Yeah. Because there are a number of mechanisms that might lead to that, of the patient's milieu of risk factors obviously contribute to this. Yeah. But we do know that stent struts jutting into the lumen of the vessel will create flow separations. Sure. And areas of low shear stress, which will obviously lead to endothelial dysfunction and therefore precipitate atherosclerosis progression. If this is important, do you think we should be moving towards thinner stent struts or the truly bioabsorbable stents as a way of getting rid of the stent platform that might be a nidus for long-term atherosclerosis progression? Are you in favour of that view that smaller stent struts or even the complete dissolution of the stent will help that?
I mean, in general, the answer is yes. I mean, thinner stent struts endothelialize faster. They have less flow disturbances around the stent struts for all the reasons you say. Of course, they still have to behave like a stent. They have to have sufficient strength, sufficient resistance to recoil, et cetera, to be able to scaffold the vessel. You can obviously make a stent, you know, so thin that it can do none of those things.
That's right.
But, you know, that first, you know, six-month period in particular is very important to have the type of radial strength that we need to hold the vessel open and to prevent, you know, the late vessel reconstriction that we saw. And that's what, you know, was torpedoed is a strong word, but that was the minor downfall in the BVS stent, absorbed stent cohort A. Mm, it was just, you know, losing its molecular weight a little bit too early. So now the cohort B has been designed to last a couple months longer, and that seems to have made a significant improvement. So the answer is yes, but any new design brings new issues as well. So we've got to make sure that, again, by leaving a durable polymer, and this fluoropolymer in particular seems to be extremely polymer and thromboresistant and may actually be a good thing. It may, believe it or not, Ian, this fluoropolymer may be safer than a bare metal stent. By having a stent covered by the fluoropolymer, that may be safer than a bare metal stent. Mm. And the reason I say that, and I'm digressing, is that Manel Sabate reported a trial at the ESC recently called the Examination Trial. And this was about 1,500 patients with ST segment elevation myocardial infarction, our highest risk cohort, that were randomized to a Zions V everolimus eluting stent, which has the fluoropolymer on it, versus an otherwise identical bare metal vision stent. And the most striking finding was that the rate of stent thrombosis was reduced by almost two-thirds, statistically significant difference, with the fluoropolymer-coated drug-eluting stent compared to a bare metal stent within 1 year. Now, the trial wasn't powered for stent thrombosis. That was an unexpected finding, et cetera. So it's clearly hypothesis generating, but it's consistent with work that Elazar Edelman and his group in Boston have done in the animal lab, suggesting that certain types of polymers actually are safer, more thrombo and platelet resistant than bare metal stents.
Conformable, durable polymers.
At least that's what it's been shown for by Elazar Edelman, you know, and overcomes issues like malapposition, stent overlap, et cetera.
So, Greg, how the world has actually turned. At one stage, we thought it was inappropriate to do a balloon angioplasty in the setting of myocardial infarction, and then to put in a bare metal stent was seen as heresy. Mm. And now drug-eluting stents have gone through all of these trials because we're concerned that they were inappropriate for the acute setting of a thrombotic milieu of an AMI. But evidence is really suggesting that we might be better off having a drug-eluting stent, and there might be some life-saving advantages to drug-eluting stents in the setting of an AMI. Do you want to talk to that?
Well, life-saving advantages may be strong, but we've certainly seen safety, and we've seen now about a dozen randomized trials of drug-eluting stents versus bare metal stents and STEMI, the largest of which was Horizons. And about seven of these trials have 3 to 5 year follow-up now, including Horizons, which went out to 3 years. Most of these with first and second generation Cypher and Taxus stents. And basically what we saw at short-term as well as long-term follow-up is similar mortality rates, similar myocardial infarction rates, similar stent thrombosis rates, but a fairly robust 40% reduction in target lesion and target vessel revascularization. Now, to be fair, there does seem to be that there's a creeping signal towards increased late stent thrombosis beyond 1 year, although overall stent thrombosis rates are clearly very similar at the end of 3 to 5 years. But with longer-term follow-up, we may see this creeping late event rate. Clearly, right now, the risk-benefit ratio favors drug-eluting stents, at least for any lesion at moderate to high risk for restenosis after STEMI in patients who you are pretty comfortable are going to be compliant with DAPT. But I do think we still need better stents in that high-risk situation, because in Horizons, it was the most striking thing that we saw in Horizons was while there was absolutely no difference between Taxus and bare metal stent and the rate of stent thrombosis at 3 years, it was about 5%. 5% in a 100% monitored trial. If you look for this, it is happening. And that's with both bare metal and drug-eluting stents. So until we get, in my mind, until we get stent thrombosis down to zero, we have not done a good enough job with this technology.
So does that lead the way to using some of these newer stent technologies in the setting of AMI, in the setting of primary PCI?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, at TCT this week, we saw some great examples of some new technologies that I think might apply to the highest risk patients, you know, particularly those with STEMI or non-STEMI, but also complex patients, long vessels, diffuse disease, you know, small vessels, et cetera, bifurcation, CTOs, I can go on and on. So if we, and I could give you a dozen examples of each class, but if we take kind of one from each, if we first look at the metallic stents with bioabsorbable polymers, we saw the data, which was presented by one Dr. Ian Meredith at TCT, on the new Synergy stent, which is a stent that has a very low-profile platinum chromium stent, even smaller than the current stents right now on the Zions V Promus platform. And it has a very, very small layer of an abluminal PLGA bioabsorbable polymer that's eluting everolimus. And they tested it in a study, about a 400-patient study, as I recall, called Evolve, in which they looked at the classic Zions V Promus everolimus eluting stent versus the Synergy stent with one of two dose formulations, with a primary endpoint in about a 400-patient study of late loss at 6 months. And they found very similar late loss with all three formulations and very similar MACE rates with all three. So this is very, very promising that we know this polymer is gone in 3 to 4 months. Again, it's like a 5-micron polymer coating thickness. So, and the rest of the stent is just a, you know, bare metal, highly visible stent because it's platinum chromium. So the question is, will this lead to better clinical outcomes either in the first year because the polymer is not even there after a few months, or from 1 year to 5 years? And will it allow or actually facilitate short-term, you know, dual antiplatelet therapy interruption? And there are currently large-scale trials being planned.
Greg, on that data, though, there was one interesting thing about the Evolve Synergy data set was that the half dose actually resulted in almost the same late loss at 6 months as the full dose release of everolimus from the platinum chromium stent.
Well, we don't know. I don't know that that's stent specific. We don't know what the floor is for Limus drugs. And I mean, so for example, you know, there were some studies with the original Cypher drug with a Cypher stent with a half dose sirolimus eluting stent. And at least it was only tested in simple lesions in the DDE trial or D3 trial. And it was just as effective. The 10 microgram per centimeter squared dose of everolimus was chosen just because that was the lowest one they tested. And it was as safe, as effective as any higher doses. So we don't know how low we can go. You know, that's the beauty of these Lymus drugs, is there's a very wide toxic therapeutic ratio.
Now, before we close, I have to talk to you about the Syntax four-year data results.
Sure.
And what does that actually mean, particularly if you could focus on the left main and perhaps the three-vessel data sets. I think we saw some very interesting data, and I'd love to get your perspective on what that means.
Yeah. Well, you know, Syntax was, one of the most important trials of the last 5 years, maybe the most important trial of the last 5 years in many respects. And, of course, it was an 1,800-patient randomized trial of stenting with patients in left main and or triple vessel disease with a taxus stent versus bypass surgery. Mm-hmm. And at 1 year, there was no significant differences for the three important endpoints of composite death, MI, stroke. There was less stroke with PCI, but there was more target vessel revascularization with bypass surgery. Now, we broke it down and, Patrick Sirois and the Syntax investigators broke it down and looked at the outcomes according to the Syntax score. So you could basically say the low-risk Syntax tertile is very simple cases for PCI, moderate-risk Syntax tertile, less than 22, 22 to 33, greater than or equal to 33, middle Syntax tertile, moderately complex for PCI, and high-risk Syntax tertile, very high risk for PCI in very complicated cases. And when you looked both at the early results and the later results, in the overall population, you see a gradient of effect. And because the PCI results are very dependent on that anatomic complexity of the Syntax score, where the surgical results were fairly independent. So when you follow the overall outcomes to 4 years, they're getting more and more concerning. Looking at the entire population, these 1,800 patients that were randomized, you now see significant differences in cardiac death, favoring bypass surgery over taxus multivessel left main stenting. You see the stroke differences, which were significant at 30 days, are now only borderline significant, but that's just because more events are accruing equally in both arms. So there's still clearly a difference in stroke, is my interpretation. There's more myocardial infarctions, though, in the taxus arm, and there's much more target vessel revascularization. So as an entire group, really only the low-risk Syntax tertile looks acceptable at 4 years. However, at TCT this year, we had the first presentations of the important separate left main cohort and triple vessel disease cohorts. And the results are very, very different, actually. Mm. The good news for interventionalists was that the left main cohort continues to look very good. Especially the low-risk and the intermediate-risk Syntax tertiles. The results are very robust. The curves are not narrowing. There's reductions in stroke with PCI. The TVR rates are not different. And, in fact, depending on the patient complexity, there's trends towards lower mortality with PCI. The high-risk Syntax tertile with left main disease looks like it should be treated with surgery. On the other hand, when you look at the multivessel disease patients, you have to hold your breath, because the outcomes are just getting worse and worse for PCI compared to surgery, and the low-risk Syntax tertile there looks just okay, acceptable, whereas the moderate and high-risk Syntax tertiles clearly, on the basis of this study, should be sent to surgery.
So, Greg, just two quick questions to wrap this up. And the first one I'd like to ask you is, has the results from the high-end the upper tercile of multivessel disease changed your practice or just reinforced the views that you already had about multivessel disease? And secondly, do you think we would see the same results in the same directions with these newer drug-eluting stents, the abluminal biabsorbable polymer stents, or indeed fully biabsorbable stents?
Well, this is really the question. I think when you looked at the taxus stent, which was a very good stent in its time, in that trial, I think it was just a little outmatched by the extent of coronary artery disease. The stent thrombosis rate at 4 years was 8.8%. So we now have stents like Zion's V-Promis, and I think this new generation of stents, will have as good or better freedom from stent thrombosis. And we see 70% reductions in stent thrombosis in head-to-head randomized trials. 70%. That's a huge addition in terms of incremental safety. In addition, there's greater efficacy than the taxus stent. So there have actually been presentations at TCT that syntax would have been completely different results, would have been a positive trial for PCI had the newer generation stents been used from today, let alone from 5 years from now. So I think that's very important in the equation. This is a very rapidly evolving field, which is difficult for people to absorb evidence-based medicine and then say, well, what relevance is that if those aren't the kinds of devices and technologies I'm applying now? But bypass surgery is also getting better and better. And so this, Ian, for example, is why we're running the EXCEL trial, which is a 2,600-patient randomized trial in drug of left main, unprotected left main intervention in the lower two-thirds syntax core tertiles, less than or equal to 32, with the Zions Prime stent versus bypass surgery to see if this difference in stent technology really makes a difference. So a long answer to your question, but the answer is, we learned in the last couple months, and especially the last week, I think, at TCT, an incredible amount that has focused us on taking better care of patients. We're focused on the high-risk ACS patient. We've got to use our best stents in those patients. We've got to use our best pharmacology in those patients. We have to be able to balance this risk of ischemia versus bleeding, and we've got to continue on this path to develop newer and safer drugs and devices for these high-risk patients. We have a little bit more leeway in low-risk patients, where some of the older devices and drugs are probably pretty good, and yes, they'll get a little bit better with the newer ones, but there's really this dichotomy in my mind now of high-risk versus low-risk, which is more important today than it's ever been.
Well, that's perhaps a great place to wrap it up. And Greg, thank you very much for spending time with us today. I think it's been a wonderful TCT, and we've seen a great range of products and devices and clinical trials presented here. And most importantly, we see that the interventional cardiology has a very bright future because many of the major issues are indeed being addressed. So I'd like to thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity, New Stent Technologies, Clinical Applications of Evidence-Based Medicine. To participate in the CME Activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.